Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maria Mazziotti-Gillen. Maria Mazziotti-Gillen is a recipient of the 2011 Barnes & Noble Writers for Writers Award from Poets and Writers, and the 2008 American Book Award for her book All That Lies Between Us, published by Guernica Editions. She is the founder and executive director of the Poetry Center at Passaic Community College in Paterson, New Jersey, and editor of the Paterson Literary Review. She is also director of the Creative Writing Program and professor of poetry at Binghamton University, SUNY. She has published 14 books of poetry, including The Weather of Old Seasons, Cross-Cultural Communications, and Where I Come From, Things My Mother Told Me, Italian Women in Black Dresses, and What We Pass On, Collected Poems, 1980 to 2009, also by Guernica Editions. With her daughter, Jennifer, she is co-editor of four anthologies, Unsettling America, Identity Lessons, and Growing Up Ethnic in America from Penguin Putnam, and Italian American Writers on New Jersey, published by Rutgers. Now, her new book is called The Place I Call Home, and it's published by New York Quarterly Books. Just in 2012, it's brand new, so really happy to have you here, Maria.
Thank you, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here. It's always wonderful to talk with you and also to be with such a great poet.
Oh, thank you so much. So you're going to start with some poems from your new book?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to start with a poem because Pittsburgh reminds me of Paterson. It's bigger, but it reminds me of the places where I grew up. All his life, my father worked in factories or mills, as we called them, back when Paterson was the silk capital of the USA and was known as Silk City. When my father was 30, he had a large tumor on his spine, and after the doctors at St. Joseph's removed it, he spent 3 months in the hospital and then a year at home. He couldn't work and wouldn't let my mother apply for welfare, so we lived for a year on $300, and my $300 in 1943 was a lot more than it is now. It still wasn't enough for a family of five to live on. We ate spaghetti and farina on my mother's homemade bread every day. When my mother was dying, she worried that the year without money, when she couldn't give my sister 5 cents to buy milk in school, was when my sister got rheumatoid arthritis at 30, a disease that progressed, eventually invading her lungs and eyes. After the surgery, my father had a limp that became gradually worse as he grew older. He was no longer strong enough to lift the heavy rolls of silk, so he got a job as a janitor in Central High School. And when that became too much, he took a job watching the pressure gauges on steam boilers to make sure they didn't explode. All his life, my father walked, dragging that dead leg behind him. All his life, he worked menial jobs, though he did income taxes each year for half the Italians in Riverside by reading the 200-page income tax book. And he could add, multiply, and divide in his head faster than an adding machine. He was fascinated by politics and read news magazines and newspapers and knew the details of world crises and war. When I was a girl, I worked in factories during the summers, and I moaned and complained about how boring it was, how dusty and tiring, how I'd shoot myself if I had to do this job for one more day. And to think of my father with his sharp intelligence, forced each day for 50 years to work 8 hours a day at jobs so repetitive they would have bored a mouse. And the way he never complained, never said, "I can't do this anymore." Instead, he just kept working, knowing he had to do it so his children would have the soft lives he never had. And I'm going to read another poem, a poem about my mother, called The Little General. My brother called my mother the Little General when we were teenagers, my brother driving the car, my mother sitting next to him, her head a small dark knob barely reaching the top of the seat. My bossy mother who told us how to live our lives, my mother who was always moving. When I remember her, I see her almost as a blur, like the cartoon of the Roadrunner. My mother, who washed all the dishes as soon as the last bite of food vanished from the plate. My mother, who held my doctor brother's foot until he fell asleep when he was still a boy. My mother, who sat at the kitchen table with us, always ready to hear the stories of our lives, ready to tell the stories of hers. My mother, who told me everything that was wrong with me, so I still hear her voice, though she said she told me for my own good. My mother, who loved the feel of the earth on her hands, who smelled of flour and spices, who baked thousands of loaves of bread, cooked innumerable fragrant meals for her children and grandchildren in her basement kitchen. My mother, who taught me how to laugh. My mother, who could not read or write. And though she wanted to go to school, my father wouldn't let her. Women don't need to go to school, he said. My mother, who did not know how much money my father had in the bank and never wrote a check. My mother, who wanted to learn how to do everything. My mother, who could quote poems she memorized in third grade in Italy before she had to leave school. My mother, who drew an imaginary line around us to keep us close. The front stoop, our boundary, the family, our country. Her little sturdy body better than any magic charm. My mother, whose skin turned orange before she died, though the week before she got sick, she planted a huge garden. We were sure she was too powerful to die. Ma, even now, 20 years after the funeral procession led us to Calvary Cemetery and to the mausoleum drawer they filed you in, I wish I could drive over to your house and find you there, your earthy humor, your warm arms that always were the place I call home.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maria Mazziotti Gillen, and she's reading from her new book, The Place I Call Home. Maria, I want to ask you about this issue of class that's all through your work, and can you talk about if you always wrote about class, or how did you come to write about class in your poetry?
Well, I'll say that, you know, I started writing poetry when I was really young. And the only thing I knew about poetry was the poems that teachers read to us in grammar school. And I loved the sound of English. I loved the sound of Italian because that meant home. But I also loved the sound of English and of people reading aloud in English. I still love it. I still love the sound of somebody reading a story in English or telling a story in English. There's something beautiful about the movement of the language and the music of it. So very early, I tried to write poems. And my first poem was published when I was 13. I actually had written it when I was about 10 and took several years for it to appear in the magazine. When it did appear, it was a rhyming poem about a dog. And I didn't have a dog. I knew absolutely nothing about dogs. And so I write this, and I realized by the time I was 13, I had started to read some of the wonderful American poets and British poets and of the 20th century and started to understand what I didn't know about poetry. For a long time, I think I was very influenced by everything I read. So I would be reading E. Cummings, and I'd write poems like E. Cummings, and I'd be reading Edna St. Vincent Millay, and I'd write poems about Edna St. Vincent Millay. It wasn't until my first book was published, and it was a book that actually won a prize, but it had a lot of poems in it that were poems that were imitations of English Romantic poets and of all the people whose work I had studied, both when I originally went to graduate school when I was a young woman and when I went back. And my graduate school professor said to me, you know, it's in this one poem about your father that you find the story you have to tell. And that's when I started writing poems about class and about what it was like to grow up in a very much working class neighborhood, a neighborhood of immigrants, how many class markers there are that you don't know exist until you're older and look back and realize what you didn't know, and how much I carried with me of that sense of being ashamed of my class and then wanting to write about it in the worst way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened with me is that my daughter and I worked on Unsettling America together because she had started teaching in a college. And she called me and said, how come none of the people who come to the Poetry Center to read are represented in any of these anthologies? And so I started sending her poems, and then she sent me poems she found. And we put together Unsettling America. When we put together Unsettling America, we realized that people were really talking about class more than race, more than ethnicity. What they were really discussing is their the social class and how it shaped them. Mm-hmm. And that led to the next anthology. So okay. Class is very important in my work. And I, in a way, I feel lower class people don't have that many people to speak for them. And so we have to speak very loudly and often.
Okay. Okay, great. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. This is a poem about my husband who had early onset Parkinson's disease and the shame that is involved in feeling that you failed somebody, that you weren't quite strong enough or something. The other night you came home. The other night you came home from the church where your friend took you to have your picture taken for the parish book. I hear the scritch, scritch of your wheelchair on the kitchen tiles. And then you are next to me, handing me a sheaf of photos. I really look sick, don't I, you ask. And I scan the pictures and know the camera has captured what neither one of us lets ourselves see. Their illness is progressing so quickly that now even your face looks delicate, the skin drawn so tightly over the bones of your head that it's almost transparent. Your neck so thin it cannot support your head. Your eyes fix on me. I know you need me to say it's not so bad, and I do, of course, but the pictures offer such solid evidence. How much of our conversation now is based on lies? The lies I tell you so you won't know how you look. The lies I tell myself so I won't have to know how much worse you are now than even 6 months ago. How complex it all is. How sometimes I want to excuse my own desire to run away, to keep myself so busy I won't have time to think about anything. I drag out things you did to me 40 years ago so I can be angry with you, to excuse my own need sometimes to get in my car and drive away from you, you in your electric wheelchair, you who insist you can walk and fall, so your legs and arms are marked by bruises and scars. The way you scatter food off your fork onto the floor, the slowness of each movement, the excruciatingly long time it takes you to eat your dinner, the way sometimes my impatience is an itch I can't scratch for fear of hurting you, and the lies have become the crutch I use to get through each day, the face in my own mirror, one I can no longer stand to see. Okay, and I'll read another poem, and one about a slightly different topic. And just a second, I just have to find the poem. You know, when you have a new book, sometimes it's difficult to find poems that are in the book. I don't know if you understand what I mean, but sometimes you think, well, I'm going to go read this. Okay, I'm going to read a poem. My daughter will probably kill me, but I'm going to read a poem called A Poem About a Turnip. We won't say which daughter this is about, okay? I could write a poem about a turnip or a sweet potato, but what good would it do? My ex-son-in-law, the one who hurt my daughter so badly that I don't know if she'll ever recover, served me turnips once. I hated them, so white and bland and difficult to swallow, like his betrayal, his words. I've met someone else. I want a divorce. I imagined my daughter standing in their small apartment, her face shock silent, her eyes filling with tears. You're beautiful, he tells her. You'll find someone else. She comes home to me, walks into my arms and sobs. We spend that entire weekend crying, though I try to hide my tears from her, even as she soaks my shirt with her own. I hit my ex-son-in-law in the head with a turnip or a really big uncooked sweet potato if I could. I think of my daughter so distraught that year that she drove into the back of her friend's car, that she tells me she dreamt about him and that he was in bed with her, dreamt he had come back, and then he said he changed his mind and vanished. She woke up sobbing. We were together 11 years, she tells me, 11 years. And then she starts to pretend it doesn't matter, pretend it never happened, pretend she is happy being alone. Whenever I think of turnips, I think of him. The mask he wore around us that made me believe he was my son. The letters he wrote to me after they divorced, saying he wanted to be my friend. The way he shook off their 11 years together and went on with his life. Behind his face, his loving smiles, they hid another face, ugly and unfeeling, as the turnips he served so proudly.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maria Mazziotti Gillen. Maria, I want to ask you about your courage. I mean, there's so much courage in your poetry, and just knowing you, I know that you're a very courageous woman. But can you talk about that? Because, you know, we have a lot of listeners out there, maybe some women out there who are afraid to write something down or afraid to write at all. And can you talk about where you found that?
It's interesting that you asked me that, because my mother was horrified by my first book, and it was really the most cowardly book that I've ever written, and the most in the English literary tradition. And she said, why can't you make up a pass for us of wealth and opulence, and because I don't like people knowing about me, and I don't want you to write about me anymore. And there's a kind of prohibition in many homes about not talking about what's going on inside the home and not telling your secrets and not letting other people know. And so I had to overcome the voice in my own head that kept saying, well, you can't write about that. Can you talk about the time your husband almost pushed you down the stairs? Can you talk about a marriage, which I was very lucky. I had a wonderful marriage, but we were very electric together. So we had moments when we were kind of yelling at each other and having fits. And did I want to talk about that in a poem? No, but I thought that I had to be honest in poems and say the way things really were. Do I want to talk about the fact that my son really doesn't like me very much? No. Do I want to talk about the fact that he's an arch conservative and I'm an arch liberal? No. But there's a kind of reaching for courage in the poems that I think many women writers in this century have taught us. And I think of Adrienne Rich and getting up in the middle of the night to read Adrienne Rich's poems and what she taught me about courage in those poems and what Ruth Stone taught. And so many of the other women writers who've taken a chance on telling the truth. I think that if I had to say anything to women is that they have to find the way to tell the stories that really are the stories of their lives in their work. And the courage to be honest will come. And that there's an old lady who lives in our bellies who knows more than anyone else about really what life is and what it's like to be a woman, what it's like to be human. If it's not an old lady, it's an old man. One of my students said to me, I don't have an old woman, I have an old man. And I thought, that's true. Some of us have an old man, but whoever it is, he's wiser than we are. Mm-hmm. And he's on an instinctive level telling us how to live our lives in a courageous way and to stand up for ourselves and tell the stories that really need to be told. Mm-hmm. We don't need to write. I really encourage people not to feel that they have to write poems that are totally intellectual and removed. Mm-hmm. Because I think that there's a movement, especially among some academic women now, to try to encourage women to write like that. And I think it really will destroy us if we do that, that we give something very important when we tell the truth about our lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I hope we do anyway.
Yeah. Well, you do, definitely. And well, now that you've broken through, you know, that fear over the years, is it still difficult for you to do that and to tell the truth in a poem?
Well, it's not difficult for me to write the poem, but sometimes I start crying in the middle of writing the poem. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's difficult for me to read the poem the first two times.
Okay. That
it'll really get to me, and I realize just how naked I am up there.
Right.
And at my age, I really don't want to be naked in front of 35,000 people or something. So I prefer to keep it all covered up. But just like in the poem, I have to do it.
Right.
And I'm driven to do it and driven to feel that if I don't show courage, how can I teach my students how to show courage?
Right. Exactly. Okay. Could you read some more?
Sure. I think I'm going to read a couple of poems from what we pass on. One poem that I was 50 before I had the nerve to write this poem. I have to say it was very, very hard poem for me to write. I was so ashamed of having done this to my father, who would have let a car run over him for me. Daddy, we called you Daddy when we talked to each other in the street, pulling on our American faces, shaping our lives in Patterson slang. Inside our house, we spoke a Southern Italian dialect mixed with English, and we called you Papa. But outside again, you became Daddy, and we spoke of you to our friends as my father. Imagine we were speaking of that Father Knows Best TV character in his dark business suit, carrying his briefcase into his house, retreating to his paneled den, his big living room and dining room, his frilly aproned wife who greeted him at the door with a kiss. Such space and silence in that house. We lived in one big room, living room, dining room, kitchen, bedroom, all in one, dominated by the gray oak dining table around which we sat, talking and laughing, listening to your stories, your political arguments with your friends. Papa, how you glowed in company light, happy when the other immigrants came to you for help with their taxes or legal papers. It was only outside that glowing circle that I denied your long hours as night watchman at Royal Machine Shop. One night, riding home from a date, my middle-class American boyfriend kissed me at the light. I looked up and met your eyes as you stood at the corner near Royal Machine. It was nearly midnight, January, cold and windy. You were waiting for the bus, the street light illuminating your face. I pretended I did not see you, let my boyfriend pull away, leaving you on the empty corner waiting for the bus to take you home. You never mentioned it, never said you knew how often I lied about what you did for a living, or that I was ashamed to have my boyfriend see you, find out about your second shift work, your broken English. Today, remembering that moment, still illuminated in my mind by the street lamp's gray light, I think of my own son and the distance between us greater than miles. Papa, silk worker, janitor, night watchman, immigrant Italian, I honor the years you spent in menial work, slipping down the ladder as your body failed you, while your mind so quick and sharp longed to escape. Honor the times you got out of bed after sleeping only an hour to take me to school or pick me up. The warm bakery rolls you bought for me on the way home from the night shift. The letters you wrote to the editors of local newspapers. Papa, silk worker, janitor, night watchman, immigrant Italian, better than any father knows best father, bland as white rice. With your wine press in the cellar, with the newspapers you collected out of garbage piles to turn into money you banked for us, with your mouse traps, with your cracked and calloused hands, with your yellow teeth, Papa dragging your dead leg through the factories of Patterson. I am outside the house now, shouting your name. And I hope I really am shouting his name. He deserves to have his name shouted.
Great poem.
Do I have time for...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'd like to read a poem called Spike Heels. And if I could just find the poem called Spike Heels, I will read it. I know I wrote down where it was. Okay. When I was young, I did wear spike heels. I can't quite imagine it now, but I did wear these high heels. I don't think they're as high as they are. The young women wear them today, which are even higher than the ones that I wore. I will say one thing. Somebody's doing a web page for me, and he put this poem on the web page, and he put a picture of a woman with beautiful legs, the kind of legs I always wanted, you know, long, skinny legs and high heels. Uh-huh. And I got all these hits on my blog from Denmark and Sweden. And they must have been mighty disappointed when they got to this poem. In the 1950s, I wore spike heels. They were very high, but I was thin then and didn't wobble. I walked through hours at my job, my high heels twinkly as Dorothy's red slippers, heels with pointy toes, heels in every possible color, slingbacks and pumps, the clickety-clack of them on pavement, making me feel as sophisticated as Marilyn Monroe. Older now, my heels have gone lower and lower, reduced to sandals with Velcro straps to hold my triple E feet. I still watch women striding in their spike heels and wish for 1 minute that I could go back to the days when I could walk with such grace, look with longing at this marker of beauty as though I were still 16 and not this woman I've become, pounding through life on confident feet. I mean, we might want that, you know, that kind of thing we had when you were young, but I'm not sure I want the insecurity. I want to be able to really claim my place. Mm-hmm. And I think I do that. I hope I do.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
So although it'd be nice to have pretty legs, I'd rather be big mouthed than and sure of myself. I actually would much prefer to be that. Okay. I'm going to read a poem. My daughter is probably my biggest fan and sometimes my funniest critic. Anyway, my daughter tells me I practice selective memory. They erase the parts of the past I don't like or don't want to know. I deny it, but then I think maybe she's right after all, that maybe I need to soften the sharp edges of memory as though I were working colored chalk over a painting. So it must have been selective memory that I was practicing when I let myself forget that I've always loved my husband more than he loved me. That fact I forced myself to forget as he grew ill and we grew together over the years, moments glittering like golden rock, the way those remembered glimpses of a beloved face or the feel of a hand or words spoken softly stay with us and run like a vein through the lives of couples like us, long married and happy together, our lives growing to fit us like another skin. And it must be selective memory that makes me remember the explosion of love between us and not the anger with which we fought when we were young and before you got sick. One night, sitting in our bed, I am raving and furious that my friend who cried at his wife's funeral 2 months ago is already going dancing each night. I say, he'll probably be married within 6 months. And you say, if something happened to you, I would remarry. Why not? And your words sting worse than if you had slapped me, who wanted, no, expected to hear that you wouldn't want anyone but me, even if you were lying, the kind of lie we all tell to protect those we love. I can't believe you, I say, and you say, why not, why not? And I think that our daughter is right. I practice selective memory. I am angry thinking of you, like my friend, spending his wife's money on someone else. And I wish you had lied to me, as I lie so often to you, to protect you. For a moment, I see you in your electric wheelchair, dancing around the room with another woman, passing my money on to her instead of our children and grandchildren. I cannot believe how furious I am. For a few days, I don't let my pity for you touch my heart. And then we are watching the debates together, you in your wheelchair, me on the sofa. I watch you, your face twitching and moving, your neck twisting, your arms jerking. And I remember how much I love you and would, even if you married someone else, even if I had to return from my grave to haunt you, even then I can't help the tenderness I still feel when I look at you.
The poetry of Maria Masiotic Gillen. Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
Thank you, Jan. You're always wonderful.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.